I was able to switch, and now you can feel a lot. Yeah, I feel a lot lighter knowing that all of the money that you're holding in your account is going towards impact initiatives and not towards the fossil fuel sector, because especially as students, we have a lot of influence on the banks, because they look to us as a part of their business model. And knowing that we are future customers, sort of permanent customers, once you open an account with a bank, they sort of expect that you will continue to use that bank for the rest of your life. So showing that students especially are switching is definitely a scare and a threat to their reputation, forcing them to reconsider this business model that they have.
So you're running some campaigns now, and one of them is to ask the Student Society, the Simon Fraser Student Society, SFU's student society. What are you asking them to do?
Yeah, so we are asking for them to, well, first to create a committee within the council that will begin investigating switching banks. We understand that it's not just a clear-cut process of you just close all your accounts and move everything, because the SFSS is such a huge organization. They have a lot of money. They have a lot of transactions and many staff that they are paying. We know that it's not going to happen overnight, so we are asking that they create this committee that is directly focused on just how do we move our funds in the next year. The other part of it is that they will condemn the actions of Scotiabank, that they will help to amplify any initiatives that are condemning their actions, demanding that Scotiabank itself divests from fossil fuels. That's essentially what we're wanting them to do by switching banks, by threatening their reputation. We want them to reconsider even lending to fossil fuel companies at all in the first place. Yeah, and then the last piece is just to use their funds to invest in impact initiatives into the community, into projects that are going to directly help students, like affordable housing and food security, which they're already doing. They do have some investments with Vancity already, but we want to see them move the rest of their money into Vancity or another credit union that is completely fossil free. Because at the moment they have credit cards and their checking accounts with Scotiabank.
So you're also asking the university itself to also divest, in a similar sort of ask of them. I imagine for them they must have quite a lot of money to involved in a lot of different things. So you're also pushing the university to make changes.
Absolutely.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, they just recently released that they are opening an impact GIC with Vancity, $10 million, which is absolutely incredible. Great first step. But yes, we are demanding that they also switch to Scotiabank. But again, an even larger institution, it's going to take more time. But that is definitely still a focus. We're focused mainly on the SFSS right now. Can kind of use that as sort of another piece to show that, this is what students want. Students, the SFSS represents the entirety of the undergraduate student body. So for showing that this organization is willing to switch banks, why not SFU? They, their values are not representing what students want.
So what are you hearing from, well, mainly the SFSS, because that's your current focus, in response to your demands? And I understand you guys recently held a protest at the student society is building. So what are you hearing back from the SFSS right now?
Initially, the response to the protest itself was not positive, and they actually shut it down, as I'm sure that you've heard. But that was mainly on the precedent of us not having permission to be there and not booking the space. But although, I would say
isn't that the nature of a protest?
It is. So that was largely disappointing, and we were very shocked to see that that would happen in our own student union building, which is made for students to be using the space. And especially since the SFSS has a long history of supporting student activism, or so they make it out to be. So that was very negative. But in response to our actual demands letter, as Jaden was talking about before, the VP finance, and I know that there's been kind of a transition in who was in that role, but I know that both the past VP finance in the SFSS and the current one, or transitioning one, are supportive of our demands, and they've agreed to meet with us, which we will hopefully be doing soon, to discuss essentially the timeline of when we can get our demands pushed for in council and in the SFSS as a whole, because I think that that was kind of the only thing that we're missing so far, because they are on our side and they are actively wanting to switch to Van City.
That's great. So it seems like, you know, your pushing is having some effect here. So what other, where do you see this going forward? Will you just continue your discussions with the SFSS?
We plan to work closely with them moving forward. And they agreed that they would like to create this committee that would be strategizing how to move their money from their checking accounts and their credit cards, because I know they have large loans with Scotiabank, and working with SFU 350 itself. So we would be a part of that committee. So I expect that we will be meeting with them frequently as members of that committee. The process itself will probably take about a year, is what they expect. With how much money is being moved around with among members of the SFSS right now, and having to pay their staff and everything. But yes, we're really excited to get to work with them so closely, and to be a part of this broader national campaign that is working at universities all across Canada, that together are requesting that our student union switch banks, that the different on-campus branches of the big banks, mainly RBC, that's a frequent one that you'll see on university campuses, that they get shut down, and that we collectively sort of ban the big banks from our campuses in Canada.
Great. So if students are, or others are interested in finding out more or getting involved with SFU 350, how do they do that?
There are actually several ways that you can get involved. Like we were talking about before, we have several different working groups. And as for the logistics of getting involved, I think that the best way to reach out is through our Instagram and our social media in general. We have a recruitment form, and there's also the option to join the club through the SFSS Go website. And that's actually my job to respond to the intake that we, or the outreach rather, that we have from students who are interested. And after that, we set up a little onboarding session to teach students a little bit about the history of the club and ways that they can get involved in current initiatives. And yeah, I think that it's a really great process to learn more about what we do and where your specific skills can fit in.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining me today. Good luck with your campaigns and your continued activities on behalf of the planet. Jaden Dyer and Natasha Ivko of SFU 350, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. This is Speak Up for Monday, April 3rd. Thanks for listening. In a couple of moments, we're going to have our interview on Looking at Lyme with Dr. Neil Nathan, a very interesting series. You know, specifically, it's about Lyme disease, but it really is about so many other issues related to brain and mental health. So we'll be with that in a minute. But first up, here is Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Carrie Sasperdis is the leader of the Feminist Bird Club of Boston.
For me, birding is being able to engage all of my senses and be present in the moment. I don't feel pressure to socialize or keep up the pace of a conversation.
For Carrie, birding is a way to become absorbed in the sensations of the outside world, something that can be difficult for them to do elsewhere as an autistic person with an auditory processing disorder.
I do think in images. I don't necessarily think in language. I do have to kind of translate pictures in my brain into words to either speak or to write down. But with birding and really engaging my visual senses, and especially being able to notice patterns and distinctions, I can compare that very quickly in my mind to images I've seen in a field guide.
Carrie advocates for making the birding world more accessible for neurodivergent people. While they've seen programs designed specifically for autistic children, Carrie says it's important to ask autistic adults what they want from birding too.
Autism doesn't stop at age 18 when the services do. You know, and people are autistic throughout their entire lifespan. And so I think, you know, intentionally engaging with the neurodivergent community and autistic adults to help design more inclusive programming, more accessible sites and activities, more accessible and inclusive outings and birding organizations is really paramount. I think it's really important for us to be recognized as the experts on our own experience and our own access needs.
For Bird Note, I'm Connor Guerin.
Welcome back to part two of our interview with Dr. Neil Nathan. Can we touch briefly on Bartonella infections? I know that's probably something we could talk about for a long time, but are you seeing a lot of Bartonella in some of your patients as well?
Oh, loads. Bartonella, I think, and I know that Dr. Horowitz agrees with me, I think is the nastiest of the infection. As nasty as Lyme is, and it is, I think Bartonella is a little bit harder to treat and a little bit more entrenched. And it's the last of the big three to be discovered, so that some Lyme doctors haven't quite gotten around to embracing it the way we have Lyme itself and then Babesia. So the history of this is that first we learned about Lyme. Then we realized that a lot of people who had Lyme had Babesia, which is not a bacteria, but a protozoa. We then realized that some people also had, fill in the blank, Bartonella or Ehrlichia and whatever other tick-borne vector illnesses you want to throw in there. But because Bartonella was discovered last of the three, it hasn't quite reached consciousness, kind of in the same way that mold hasn't, because it was discovered even after Bartonella was discovered. So depending on a physician's background, it's like, oh, I'm really comfortable treating Lyme. Now I got comfortable treating with Babesia, less so with Bartonella, and even less so with mold. It's that progression. But the bottom line is that Bartonella is very common, more common than Babesia. But when we do studies of tick populations and analyze what's in that tick. We find that 40% of ticks carry in different parts of the country. In my part of the country, 40% carry Lyme and 40% carry Bartonella, 10% carry Babesia, 8% carry Ehrlichia. So we're talking about a bacteria that is quite common. It does carry some symptoms that distinguish it from Lyme per se. A pain on the bottom of the feet in the plantar fascia area is unique. A vibrational perception of internal vibration or tremor, which people can feel on the inside, but it can't be seen on the outside, from my experience, is either Bartonella or mold. Okay. Bartonella, more than Lyme by far, predisposes to intense anxiety or depression, almost the feeling of hopelessness. Bartonella carries with it a very intense perception. So sometimes you can make the diagnosis of Bartonella just from a patient's description of it. An example is sometimes patients will say, using their hand gestures, I can feel it crawling around in my scalp and moving this way and going that way. And it's this burning, itching. It isn't the description. It's the intensity of the description that labels it as Bartonella. That's right. Really quite pathognomonic for Bartonella.
Wow. I'm just wondering, so what can patients do to deal with the overwhelm as they move through illness, diagnosis, treatment, and recovery? Because, you know, there's just so much to be learning and to be considering. And, you know, sometimes you're also dealing with the challenge of finding the right healthcare provider as well.
Right. Particularly hard in Canada, where there are not a lot of physicians who are doing this kind of work.
That's right.
And I appreciate that. Sorry, guys, you may have to come down to the States if you want to get treated. Mm-hmm. That's not saying that we have it nailed, but there are more of us doing this kind of work.
Right, and collaborating together, too.
So the number one thing for a patient to understand is this is treatable.
Mm-hmm. That's a great message.
If you can be patient, getting mold out of the body requires at least a year or more most of the time. Getting Lyme or co-infections out of the body, at least a year or most of the time. So it's not a short trip. So you have to be in for the long haul, and you have to have your expectations reasonable. You have to be patient with your doc, and you have to be patient with yourself and your family. So the quality in people that enable them to do this journey is perseverance. Some type of discipline, just stick-to-itiveness. And understand, I'm just going to come at this one step at a time in the most logical way. If I have sensitivities or emotional issues or mast cell-type symptoms, I'll treat that first. Once that's treated, then I can treat either mold or Lyme, whichever one is present in whatever order we want to do it. And I'm just going to come at it slowly and steadily.
Mm-hmm.
Not if you rush into it, okay, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, and load me up with antibiotics and hit it hard. You're asking for trouble. It's a very, very bad way to do this. Bodies do not like being slammed. And they will let you know that.
Mm-hmm.
So coming at it gently, slowly, with respect, honoring the body, honoring the body's need to take the time it needs to go where it needs to go, that's where we're going with this. So if there's one quality that enables us to distinguish those folks who get well from those who don't, the ones who stick to it will almost always get well. The ones who get frustrated and give up and go, oh, I've been doing this for 3 years and I'm not as good as I need to be. I'm sorry that it takes that long. If we knew how to do it better and faster, we would.
And maybe we'll get there one day. I know for myself, I was using a chronic pain app and I was tracking my progress. And eventually over time, I could see that my symptoms were diminishing in intensity. And it was nice to have that tracking for myself to see that it was changing.
Now, it may be expensive, but if you can find a healthcare provider who has experience, they can help you and support you while you do this. In my practice, I found that a lot of my visits with patients were basically pep talks, which is, we've got you on a good program. You are making progress. I know it's slower than you want it to be, but hang in there. Keep going. Keep. Remember how sick you were when we started.
Right.
And know how you're not that sick anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So hang in there. And those pep talks were essential for a lot of people in helping them to get well. And it's really helpful if you have a supportive series of friends and family. If your family doesn't understand it, and that's very, very common, beg them, plead them to read more about it so that they can understand what you're going through.
Now, I know you are a prolific author. Can you tell us about your recent book, Energetic Diagnosis?
Okay. I can. Actually, your audience would probably be more interested in my earlier books.
Okay.
So the book that you'd probably get the most from is called Toxic, Heal Your Body from Mold Toxicity, Lyme Disease, Multiple Chemical Sensitivities, and Other Environmental Illnesses. That is a very comprehensive overview of all of this that I think would help a lot of people to understand the bigger picture. There's a short version for mold that's an ebook just called Mold and Mycotoxins, which I updated this year. So it's called Mold and Mycotoxins, Current Evaluation and Treatment 2022.
Great.
So it's a 40-page ebook. It's easier to read for families or patients. It's a starting point where you can go, oh, okay, now I understand more about what Neil is babbling about.
That's great. We'll post the link in our show notes as well.
Okay. And now, Energetic Diagnosis is a very different book. It's about using personal and devices of energy to make diagnosis and inform treatment. In other words, it's a plea for physicians to take intuition seriously so that they can use it in a more profound way to make diagnoses. It is my belief that doctors do it already, mm-hmm. but no one's willing to talk about it. And so basically I wanted to start the dialogue.
That's great.
And then I have a whole section in the book on a variety of energetic approaches, medical devices that do measure energies, that do allow us to potentially make a diagnosis and then follow up that diagnosis by seeing how the energies are improving. So it's a very different book. And my new book, which is just about finished, is called Why Am I So Sensitive and What to Do About It? And it's a book that focuses on the type of sensitivity that a lot of patients with mold and Lyme develop as they go through their illness. We're talking sensitivities to stimuli like light, sound, chemicals, EMF, food. And it talks about a lot of those patients have been disregarded and dismissed by the medical profession. They've been told, you're the only one who can smell that. It must be, you're the problem. Well, the process of sensitizations makes those folks indeed have a much better sense of smell than other people, so that they can smell mold where no one else can. They can indeed be affected by scents that no one else is detecting. It's very real. And a part of it is that many of those folks have not gotten the care from medical practitioners that they need. And the book is to explain to both them and to practitioners the physiology of it, which we now understand, and how to treat it. And I've got a fabulous group of authors writing it with me. I mean, I wrote maybe a third of the book. And then I had, on the limbic system part, I had Annie Hopper and Ashok Gupta write a chapter. I had Stephen Porges write a chapter on the vagal system.
Wow.
Okay. I have experts. I have Rich Horowitz writing about Lyme. I have just experts writing about all of the different treatments, where we talk about the use of ketamine, we talk about LDI, we talk about thiamine specifically, and all those, we talk about oxalates and salicylates as sensitizing agents. So it is, my hope was to put together a really comprehensive book written by the people who are the most expert on the pioneering cusp right now. And we got that. So this should be a very important book. And it's just going to the editor now.
Oh, wow.
To get it.
That's so exciting.
I hope, and my hope is that it'll be out by late winter. And it should be really helpful for, there are millions of people suffering with sensitivities now. Mm-hmm. And my hope is that many of them will then understand, okay, this is not in my head. This is the physiology of it. This is how I got it. And this is how I can get well from it. So I'm kind of excited about that.
Oh, I'm excited to read it as well. And as we wrap up our conversation, is there any emerging research that you're excited about?
The one that I think is the most exciting is the work that Rich Horowitz has been doing with his double dapsone protocol. Rich has found in the last year, and he's published two papers on it. His protocol is available through his website. You can Google his name and get his double dapsone protocol if you want to know more about it. But he has found that the use of dapsone in specific doses, along with methylene blue and sometimes a little bit of disulfiram, in addition to the antibiotics that we typically use for Lyme and bacteria and Babesia, get at the persister cells that we know exist for both Lyme and Bartonella. And so Rich is getting, and I've followed his protocol for a number of years, we're able to help and treat people we have not been able to treat in the past. So that is the biggest new development that I'm aware of.
Oh, wonderful. Well, Neil, I really appreciate your time today. It's such a pleasure to meet you, and I'm just really grateful that you took the time to speak to us and our audience today. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for having me.
We learned so much about the dysfunction of the limbic and vagal systems, mast cell activation, mold, and cell danger response. And the great news is that with perseverance and the right treatments, recovery is possible. That's a wrap on another great interview. Stay safe in the outdoors.
Thank you to Sarah Cormode and looking at Lyme for that very interesting feature. We're just about at the end of our show today. Thanks for tuning in to Speak Up this Monday morning. I'm your host, Magnus, and I'll be back in this chair next week. And we'll be bringing you our regular features, What's Up in Burnaby, and a whole bunch more interesting content. Tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., Vivian will be stepping into the seat here, or I guess sitting down in the seat here, and bringing you another episode of Speak Up. And she's been got a bunch of stories she's been working on for tomorrow. So that is that to look forward to. If you're sticking around this afternoon, coming up in just a few minutes is Democracy Now, and later on at noon is Wandering Rhythms. Thanks for tuning in today. We're going to play a little bit of some new pornographers here to end the program. Thanks for tuning in.